Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Captain Beefheart thought he saw a woman turn into a fish in the audience, and she had bubbles coming out of her mouth. And when he saw this, he walked off the front of a 10-foot stage and landed in the mud.
Hey everybody, it is Patrick here, and we are about to undertake another series on Rockin' the Suburbs, and joining me on this series is Kurt Gallagher. Kurt, how are you, man?
I'm great, Patrick. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for being here. It wasn't all that long ago we did a series on a guitar player. and this series, you know, in some ways I think is going to be, you know, kind of similar. But I don't know exactly how to describe this person. I was thinking to myself, like, I can't really say he's reinvented American music because it goes so much broader than that. But there's something about this musician where he has combined an incredible musicianship. He can play almost every fretted instrument with amazing skill and passion and sympathy. And yet he spent a lot of his time sort of unearthing eras of music from times gone by. And the person I'm describing is Ry Cooder. How do you put him, Kurt, somewhere on the musical spectrum? Like, maybe he needs his own, like, separate little area. I don't know.
I have a list, if you want to hear my list of things to call him.
Yeah, that would be great.
A historian, musicologist, slide guitar hero, archivist, rock and roll rebel. I put in parentheses punk rocker. We can talk about that later. But okay. American treasure, definitely. But he just calls himself a guitar player from Santa Monica.
Well, let's start there because, you know, I think our audience being, you know, kind of musicologists themselves in some ways, will have varying degrees of knowledge about Ry Cooder. And so we thought we would start at the beginning and just try to tell the whole sprawling tale. And Ry Cooder was playing guitar, from what I understand, you know, out in Santa Monica, like by the age of three, he had been given a guitar or something like that, right?
Yeah, around four, he had a neighbor who was a violist, a classically trained violist, and was working, but was out of work because of the blacklist.
Okay.
He was a neighbor of Ry's family, and Ry's mom and dad used to have a lot of sing-alongs. They were left-wing folk music enthusiasts, even though his dad was an accountant. But they had a lot of get-togethers at their house, a lot of hootenannies, and people would come over and play music. And when Ry was three, he had a terrible accident.
Yeah.
He was fixing a toy car with a knife. And he was only 3 years old, so he probably didn't really have fixing skills at that age. And while he was doing that, the knife went into one of his eyes. And it was a terrible accident. And he had to spend a year in dark rooms, hoping that the eye would heal. And eventually it didn't heal. And he spent the rest of his life with one glass eye.
Right.
But during this episode, he was spending a lot of time in this dark room just trying to, you know, heal and recover. And their neighbor, this violist, brought over a guitar, and he was laying in bed, and the guy put the guitar on his chest and strummed a chord on it.
Wow.
And he said he felt the vibrations go through his body, and he said it was like a magic carpet.
Wow.
And he, that's when he started. He was, I think he was four at the time. The accident happened when he was three, but that he got that guitar when he was four.
Okay. Wow. That's an incredible story. It really is. And such an amazing age to have this hugely adverse thing to overcome. So it must have instilled in him some spirit for the rest of his life to just keep following, you know, his passion and what he hoped would be, you know, for lack of a better phrase, the light at the end of the tunnel that he was like going after, you know what I mean?
Yeah, really. You know, yeah, he was, since his sight was impaired, I guess he was just going on the vibrations of the music. And
yeah.
And he grew up in a house that they listened to a lot of like folk music, Josh White and Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie. Oh, and they were really into the anthology of American folk music.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
That was on at the house all the time. And soon enough, he discovered radio and he started listening to Johnny Cash. And there was a lot of hillbilly music on the radio in Santa Monica. This was in Santa Monica, which is a neighborhood of Los Angeles. And they lived on a hill above the airport. Uh-huh. And that's where all this happened. And there's a lot of really nice coincidences that happened a little bit later in his life that lead to a really great, amazing career in music. But yeah, his mailman turned him on to bluesy music. Like his parents were into folky stuff, but mm-hmm. his mailman turned him on to Skip James, Blind Blake, Sleepy John Estes, and Robert Johnson.
Wow. Now that's wild, man.
And the guy that gave him, the viola player that gave him the guitar, was a big fan of Lead Belly. So he found out about Lead Belly first, and then later through the mailman, the people I just listed, he got into. And then he discovered Blind Willie Johnson on his own around the age of 12. And Blind Willie Johnson became a huge influence and became really important in his career, as we'll talk about later when we talk about the movie Paris, Texas. Mm-hmm. Blind Willie Johnson was he just kept coming back to the music of Blind Willie Johnson over and over again in his career. By the time he was 12 years old, he had discovered all this stuff.
That's unbelievable. And he considered some of the pieces of music that Blind Willie Johnson made to be among the finest ever put on recordings by human beings. And considering how much music and how many styles Ry Cooder traversed, I don't know if you could have any higher compliment for someone's music. You really couldn't.
Yeah. And it was just like a mine that he kept going back to, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't using it selfishly. He was always giving credit, you know, for everything he used. He was like a historian, so he wanted to just talk about the history of American folk and blues music.
Now, from kind of what I understand, and correct me if I'm going wrong here, did he start out playing the banjo and like getting together and playing in sort of bluegrass style combos? Because that was a very popular thing at the time, especially in California. There was a very strong folk and you know, that kind of a scene, bluegrass.
He did play the banjo, and he entered a banjo playing contest, and he took first place. I think he was like 13 or 14 at the time, but he played banjo, and he played on stage with Doc Watson and Bill Monroe when he was 15.
That blows my mind. It really does.
It was there was a club in West Hollywood called the Ash Grove. And when he was 13 or 14, he started taking the bus to the Ash Grove, and he would just hang out there. It was a bare bones folk and blues club painted black with, you know, folding chairs, and he could sit really close to the stage. And here's a list of people that would play there that he saw: Bucca White, Jesse Fuller, Mississippi John Hurt, the Stanley Brothers, Reverend Gary Davis, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, the Staple Singers. He saw all these people in this tiny little club that he would take the bus to when he was 13, crazy. 14 years old.
That is crazy.
Then when he was 15, Bill Monroe and Doc Watson were doing a tour together, and something happened to their banjo player. He couldn't make the date, and they let Ry sit in with him and play banjo.
Wow, that's incredible.
And he thought he was going to quit high school and go on tour with Bill Monroe, but Bill Monroe turned to him after the show and said, You're not ready yet, son.
Is that right? That's amazing.
But I mean, he was still pretty damn good. I guarantee
if he
you.
Said yet, if Bill Monroe said yet to Ry Cooder, he knew that one day he would definitely be good enough, which is crazy. So was he making any recordings or doing? I know a lot of people would say, you know, when they come into the Ry Cooder story or think of Ry Cooder, they would say, oh, Ry Cooder was like, you know, played with all these famous acts. Like he was a session musician more than anything else. But was he doing anything like that at the very beginning of his career, like when he was 16, 17 or something like that?
Yeah, when he was his first official gig at the Ash Grove, he hung out there for years, but his first official gig was playing guitar with Jackie DeShannon.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Jackie DeShannon's from Kentucky, and she started out really young, too. She was on the radio, and she had some hit records. She had a song called Needles and Pins.
Uh-huh.
That she recorded. She didn't make it a big hit. It became a big hit later, but she recorded Needles and Pins, Put a Little Love in Your Heart. What the World Needs Now is Love, Love, Love.
Yeah.
And she wrote pop songs like Betty Davis Eyes. But she was...
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing. And she was touring, and she wanted to get more into blues and folk. So she booked a couple gigs at the Ash Grove, and Ry Cooder was her backup. And the record, he was 16 at the time. And there are recordings available on YouTube of the performance. Oh. Really good stuff. And then he did a solo gig when he was 17 at the Ash Grove. No, I think he was still 16 when he did his first solo gig, just instrumental guitar stuff. He might have been opening for somebody, but those recordings are also on YouTube.
Very cool.
They recorded everything at the Ash Grove. Pretty amazing.
That is pretty amazing, yeah. And had incredible quality lineups as well. So that kind of brings us to an interesting, and I don't know exactly how obscure it is now because of the success that both Ry Cooder and the other person who were in this band that he formed with Taj Mahal. And that band was called Rising Suns. And were they just a product of people that were hanging around the folk and rock scenes in L.A.? Is that how they came together?
Yeah, Taj, you know, he was from Massachusetts, but he made his way out to L.A., and he started hanging out at the Ash Grove, and the owner of the Ash Grove introduced Ry to Taj, and they became fast friends. They liked the same stuff, and they got along really well, and they just became friends right away. And they started playing at Ry's house and, you know, some of Taj's friends' houses, and they started talking about forming a band. They were really young, but... they formed this band called the Rising Suns, and they got really popular really fast. They started playing at the Ash Grove, and then they started playing at the Troubadour. They played at the Whiskey a Go Go. They were playing places all over Los Angeles, like in that first year that they got together. It was crazy. The right. guys from the Rolling Stones came to watch them play at the Ash Grove. And everybody was talking about, you know, the Rising Suns. I think, you know, they're charismatic guys, these two guys.
Yeah.
And people started, record companies started trying to assign them to a deal. And there was like five record companies in competition to sign Rising Suns. And it was Rye's idea to go see a lawyer, which turned out to be a really bad idea because he just went by the best deal, the best contract. So they ended up signing with Columbia. But Columbia probably wasn't the best label for them artistically, because they didn't know how to do folk blues. They didn't know about
right.
you know, any of this stuff. They were mostly like, they started out in classical music, I think, but in the yeah. late 60s, I don't know if the Birds were on Columbia, but everybody wanted to follow the Birds and their success. They were really successful at this time. This is the late 60s,
right.
67, 66, 67. And everyone was trying to chase that Birds money. And Rising Suns ended up signing with Columbia, and they made a record. They put out a single. They did Reverend Gary Davis's Candyman. Well, he didn't write it, but he made it famous.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's terrible. I don't know. I listen to it. It's too fast. It's too crazy. But there is really good stuff on the Rising Suns record. They managed to do some really good stuff with producer Terry Melcher. But I don't think Columbia was the best company for them to be with, and Columbia never put the album out. It didn't come out until 1992.
Like you said, not only was Columbia probably not a good fit artistically, but I don't know how many record labels maybe knew how to market a racially integrated folk rock band that weren't really, they didn't look like the Birds, that's for sure. And they weren't playing the hippie game in any way. You know, they were of the earth and stuff. So it was way ahead of what a lot of things, you know, were going to be. That's for sure.
In retrospect, those guys said, you know, we didn't know how to communicate what we were doing to anybody. Yeah. And the record company was so confused about what we were doing. And they just didn't know. They didn't know how to deal with them. But they were so popular playing all those clubs and everything. People loved them. And they had a good time. It just didn't work out. But, it wasn't much of a blow to them because they just kept rolling into bigger, better stuff right after they broke up. I think when the album wasn't released, that was sort of the end of the Rising Suns.
Yeah, and from what I've read, you know, there was people were wondering, like, are the Byrds going to be the big breakout band here, or is it going to be the Rising Suns? Like, at one point, nobody knew which one it was going to be.
My dad's having a holy since I've come to Tulsa County, and I really don't know what I'm gonna do. Guess I'll mosey down along the southern border, 'cause I feel I've got to get away from you. You know in Charleston that you need a my assistance, but when I arrived you didn't need me then. I may not be a wise man, but I know the life I'm living, and you got your help from lots of other men. I don't know just where I'll go, but I guess I'll ride down to Mexico. Down to Mexico.
Well, as you said, both Taj, who went on to have a very successful solo career, and Rye just kept on rolling. And another kind of eccentric out there person who was on the scene around this time was Captain Beefheart, Don Van Vliet, and Rye hooked up with him too. You know, he kind of was bouncing around all these different places, and for a while he was in Captain Beefheart's band and played on Safe as Milk, I believe. Is that the one he played on?
He did. He was the guitar player in the Magic Band for the first album.
Yeah.
Can I go back a second to talk about McCabe's Guitar Shop?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Real quick, mm-hmm. And that'll lead us back into the Captain Beefheart stuff.
Okay, sure.
But that was the other place where he used to hang out. I think he could almost walk. I looked it up on the map, and McCabe's Guitar Shop, which is still around, was really close to the house that he grew up in, and he just started hanging out there. And it was just like guitar players. He took lessons there, and that's where he met John Fahey. And John Fahey taught him his first lessons in how to play slide guitar.
Oh, I didn't know that. How interesting. Yeah. Wow.
So he would just hang out at McCabe's during the day. He would, you know, after school or whenever, or he would just skip school and go to McCabe's and hang out. And he could take lessons from people, and he met everyone would hang out there. He probably met, you know, he probably hung out with Taj there after, you know, meeting him at the Ash Grove. But he would also stick around at the Ash Grove after the shows, and he would ask for lessons from like people like Doc Watson.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. And he would give him $5. He would say, you know, can you show me that one thing? I couldn't figure out what you were doing. He was learning from records before this Ash Grove stuff. But then when he could actually see the people, he was putting everything together. And then he would, if there was something that was still puzzling him, he would go up to the guys after the show and give them $5 to show them what he, you know, what he was to figure out. And then he got hired by McCabe's to do like some like festival appearances where they were promoting like Gibson guitars and Martin guitars. And he had a booth at a college somewhere in Los Angeles where he had a booth where he was demonstrating Martin guitars. And that's where he met Captain Beefheart.
Is that right? How cool is that?
They had a quick conversation, and he's like, this guy is really strange, but there's something I like about him.
Yeah.
And they started jamming a little bit, and Beefheart had this house out in the desert where he and the Magic Band would practice, and he invited Rye out to this house. So Rye goes out there. He's 17 years old. Rising Suns had just broken up. He gets out to this house in the desert, and Don Van Vliet, Captain Beefheart, announces that he's firing the guitar player from the Magic Band, and he's firing the bass player, and he needs new people in his band because he's tired of these people. I think he used like stress as a, I don't know, to keep the energy going at his house. But anyways,
yeah.
The guitar player whose name is, let me look it up. I want to get this right. Doug Moon was the guitar player.
Okay.
He went to his room. He was also living in this house out in the desert. He goes to his room and he gets a machine crossbow, a loaded machine crossbow. Comes back into the room where everybody's practicing and starts pointing this crossbow at everybody. And Rye said he had to get down and hide behind his amplifier. And then Captain Beefheart like said, "Doug, get out of here. You're acting crazy." And he went away. But they were all, you know, they were all doing substances, lots and lots of substances. But from that day on, Rye became a member of Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band, and he was on their first album. And there's a legendary story of him quitting the band. They were supposed to play at Monterey Pop. That would have been huge if they would have played at Monterey Pop with everybody.
They were there. Jimi Hendrix, they were ready to go.
The Who, just it was everybody was there.
Yeah.
So there was a warm-up concert 2 weeks before Monterey Pop, that which was called the Fantasy Fair and Magic Mountain Musical Festival in Marin County. There were 40,000 people there.
Holy crap.
In that festival, at this festival, it was a warm-up for Monterey Pop. The Doors were there, Canned Heat, Jefferson Airplane, The Birds, and, you know, a bunch of other, you know, probably, you know, the Jefferson Airplane might have been there. But at that concert, Captain Beefheart thought he saw a woman turn into a fish in the audience, and she had bubbles coming out of her mouth. And when he saw this, he walked off the front of a 10-foot stage and landed in the mud.
One of my all-time favorite stories in rock and roll history.
I'm sorry. I hope I'm not stealing your thunder, Patrick, because you've heard these stories too, right? I'm so sorry.
Yes. I love that story about Captain Beefheart. It's so great. To Ry Cooder's credit, he realized at that point, and maybe after the crossbow incident too, that this was not a good band to stay in.
Oh, man. It was not a healthy environment with Captain Beefheart. But
no,
they did. Was. He did open up for him a couple years later, so they remained friends. But yeah, he quit the band, and they never played Monterey Pop. They didn't have a guitar
That's
player.
Incredible. Incredible. What could have happened if they had? I mean, that was, like you said, that was the moment for California rock right there. The one big breakout moment. I will say Safe as Milk is a very excellent record. It's tight. The band is like totally chugging. There are great songs on there. Sure enough, Yes I Do is an incredible song.
There's, oh, yeah.
Just some really, really good tracks on that record. So go back and listen to that.
That's Rye, man. Rye's playing the guitars on that record. It's amazing. He was 19.
Incredible. And it doesn't sound like Trout Mask Replica or some of the later Fractured stuff. It's, you know, an early tight kind of blues with a kind of a weird edge on top, but a wild man who sounds like Hal Wolf singing, you know, in front of the band. It's really, really good stuff.
Yeah, I read an interview with Rye where he was saying that it was their idea was sort of like Chicago blues, but with like Ornette Coleman type freedom to switch, you know, time signatures and to improvise and to go off. So it was blues mixed with free jazz, and that's what they were going for. And Rye said it was a great idea. He probably would have stuck with it if Captain Beefheart wasn't so insane.
I voted mad. All right. We'll leave Ry Cooder right there for the moment as he exits the Magic Band and begins to take his next step into session work, rumors, and an intro to early film music will be the next step for Ry. And we'll hear about that in tomorrow's episode. But I want to thank Kirk Gallagher very much. And I hope everybody enjoyed this first part of the Ry Cooder experience. We're going to keep it going this week. Possibly may leak over a little bit into next week. We'll see how it all shakes out. Just get ready to keep the story going about one of the most unique musicians of the past 50 to 60 years. All right, and with that, we're going to sign off with Show Enough, Yes I Do, the first track on Safe as Milk from Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band. And we will talk to you guys with a whole lot more Ry Cooder tomorrow.
I was born in the desert, came on up from New Orleans. Came upon a tornado, so light in the sky. I wheel around all day with the moon sticking in my eye.
And everyone was trying to chase that bird's money.